Assad's regime has fallen, but what's next?
And while many people are celebrating in Syria and around the world, analysts say that the rebel victory will mean a massive power restructuring in the Middle East and warn about the potential of chaos in Syria.
Seeking security, Israel enters a demilitarized buffer zone near Syria.
Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said Israel is concerned that some of Syria's weapons could fall into the hands of those who want to harm the Jewish state.
And it's the end of an era for Taylor Swift.
And it was like so amazing, and she was so cool, and like the whole thing was so much fun, and we traded bracelets, and it was so amazing.
Today is Tuesday, December 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The top story for today continues to be Syria and the fall of Bashar Assad's regime. People in Damascus are celebrating a rebel victory that quickly swept through the country, culminating Sunday with President Bashar Assad's ouster and departure to Moscow. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul, Turkey, with Moaya Atrash and Ahmad Falia in Damascus.
Rebel soldiers and some civilians fire into the air in celebration. Damascus, the Syrian capital, that had been ruled by the Assad family, commonly known in Arabic as the regime, is now in their control. What this control will mean for residents and businesses is not yet clear, and the city was under curfew for 13 hours until Monday morning. But rebel soldiers say, for now, they are celebrating a new regime.
By God's will, Damascus will remain with the people, with freedom, with new leadership, with new government, with a new regime of freedom, a regime of patriotism, a regime of love, compassion, and mercy.
The palace of Bashar al-Assad, who was the president of Syria for 24 years until he fled to Russia over the weekend, has been ransacked. But much of the rest of the city remains untouched. Video believed to be of freed prisoners in Syria circulates online. Syrian prisons, known for the cruelest forms of torture, will long be one of the most brutal memories of Assad's rule. Locals, not giving their names, say they hope that this cruelty is now a thing of the past.
I never dreamed that I would be here. I thank God for this moment, for the dignity and honor that has been lost for years. May God honor efforts of the youth, the men who returned our honor and dignity.
In a less than two-week-long offensive, rebel forces took over Syria and the government collapsed on Sunday after nearly 14 years of war, a half million civilian deaths, and the world's largest refugee crisis. And while many people are celebrating in Syria and around the world, analysts say that the rebel victory will mean a massive power restructuring in the Middle East and warn about the potential of chaos in Syria as a transitional government establishes its rule. Heather Murdoch in Istanbul with Moawia Atrash in Damascus, Syria, VOA News.
The fall of Damascus has also raised concerns about what's next for the few U.S. troops who are based in Syria. They've been there working with allies to keep the Islamic State group from resurging. VOA's Carla Babb has more from the Pentagon.
Syrians in Damascus reacting to a world without the Assad regime in power, a first since 1971. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
It's impossible not to be moved by the scenes of jubilation, the scenes of relief coming out of Syria. The end of this regime is a defeat for all who enabled its barbarity and its corruption, none more than Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia. So this moment presents a historic opportunity, but it also carries considerable risks.
Risk that U.S. forces aimed to mitigate this week, striking 75 Islamic State targets in central Syria with B-52 bombers, fighter jets, and A-10 combat aircraft, a move meant to ensure the terror group won't try to take advantage of the situation. Michael Rubin is with the American Enterprise Institute.
The real danger moving forward over the next 48 hours is that if the Islamic State escapes its prison camp at Al-Hol, then you could have thousands of militants, thousands of extremists, not only spreading across Syria and the Middle East, but also Turkey and Europe as well.
The U.S. military has about 900 troops in Syria to help Syrian Democratic Forces prevent Islamic State from resurging, with officials stating three primary interests now that the Assad regime has fallen. Here's Robert Wood, U.S. alternate representative to the U.N.
Our soldiers and personnel and all are protected. We want to make sure that our allies are safe and secure. We want to make sure that there isn't a humanitarian catastrophe.
The ousted former president has fled to Moscow. Analysts say the fall of Syria has weakened Russia along with Iran. Michael Rubin.
They've lost Hezbollah, or at least the ability to supply them. They've lost Syria. The question now is whether they can keep their grip on the Houthis or whether other states in the region, Saudi Arabia, for example, are going to smell blood in the water.
The Pentagon says communication with allies is key. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has spoken with his Turkish counterpart about the ongoing Syrian developments. CENTCOM Commander General Eric Kurilla is in the region. He has met with Jordanian allies in Amman to discuss Syria, and officials say he plans to speak with other regional allies in the coming days. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
It's said that nature abhors a vacuum, and nowhere is that truer, perhaps, than in the Middle East. Following Sunday's overthrow of Bashar Assad, fearing weapons might get into the hands of terrorists, Israel has seized control of a demilitarized buffer zone in the Golan Heights and attacked weapons factories near Damascus. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Sar said Israel is concerned that some of Syria's weapons could fall into the hands of those who want to harm the Jewish state.
That's why we attacked strategic weapon systems, like, for example, remaining of chemical weapons or long-range missiles and rockets, in order that they will not fall in the hands of extremists.
He spoke after Israeli troops took over a demilitarized buffer zone between Israel and Syria. Israel's prime minister said Israel will not allow any hostile force to establish itself on Israel's border. But overall, Israeli analysts say Israel sees the events in Syria as an internal issue for the Syrian people, and it hopes that rebel leader Abu Muhammad al-Golani can establish ties with Israel. Dina Lisniansky is a specialist on political Islam at Tel Aviv University.
I do know for a fact that Israel has good connections already with Kurds in Syria, and the Kurds in Syria, when they approached the Israeli government, and they said that they would like to cooperate. So the Kurds, and now also the Druze in the Syrian Golan Heights, are also sending all kinds of messages that are being very peaceful.
For decades, the boundary between Israel and Syria had been Israel's quietest border following an agreement after the 1973 Yom Kippur War. But some analysts say that the new situation could eventually lead to a peace treaty between Israel and Syria. Hazem Al-Ghabra is a Syrian analyst and the founder of Frontiers Consultants based in Washington.
I'm trying to better understand if the people in Syria are maybe potentially ready to receive aid from Israel, maybe trade with Israel down the line. I think it's way too early for that. But I believe now, and this is where I disagree with half the people and agree with the other half. Israel is emerging as a regional superpower right now, at least militarily.
Israel is watching to see how Iran will react to the events in Syria. Israeli analysts believe Iran has been weakened by both Israel's rout of Hezbollah in South Lebanon and by the events in Syria. Some in Israel fear that Iran could try to reestablish deterrence by moving ahead with its nuclear program, which could spark an Israeli attack on Iran. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Turkey is one of the principal backers of some of the Syrian rebels who ousted Assad, and a likely winner as Ankara seeks to gain influence with the new government. However, analysts warn much will depend on whether a stable government can emerge after Assad's departure. Dorian Jones has that story for us from Istanbul.
The dramatic end of the Assad family's half-century's rule over Syria marks a major shift in the region's balance of power, with Turkey standing to gain as a major backer of some of the rebels who ousted Bashar al-Assad. Aydın Selcan is a former senior Turkish diplomat who served in the region and is now a foreign policy analyst for Turkey's Mediascope news portal.
Turkey emerges as the clear winner, and Iran is definitely is the loser, and Russia also is pushed aside.
While the Turkish-backed rebel group, the Syrian National Army, formerly known as the Free Syrian Army, played a role in the overthrow of Assad, it was the radical Islamist group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, that led the offensive, and that analysts say will cause unease in Ankara over Syria's future. Hussein Baja is a professor of international relations at Ankara's Middle East Technical University.
My fear is Turkey lost the control. This is the problem. Turkey cannot control because there is not only Free Syrian Army. There are many other radical groups, and who is somehow stopping them? Turkey cannot. And this is a big problem.
Turkey for years provided support and protection to the Idlib region, where the HTS was based. And analysts suggest Ankara could retain significant influence if the recent statements by the HTS leadership calling for an inclusive Syria government are honoured. Again, analyst Aydın Selcan.
If pragmatism prevails, that's perhaps where Turkey and Ankara may come in. And also, Ankara definitely will be viewed as a positive outside contributor by these new Syrian rulers, because of the fact that we here in Turkey are host to over 5 million Syrians, and that also Turkey helped protect Idlib.
Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan, addressing an international conference in Doha Sunday, pledged that Turkey is committed to helping secure a politically inclusive new Syria. A stable Syria is also key to Ankara's goal of sending home millions of Syrian refugees now living in Turkey, as public resentment over their presence grows. Analysts say Turkey's strengthened position inside its own borders makes Ankara an even more important broker for the United States and the incoming Trump administration. Sezin Öner is a commentator on Turkey's Politikyol news portal.
Trump administration would perhaps regard Turkey as a strategic asset, an important strategic partner to keep here, although they're not so much interested in alliances and partners. But they might push all this work on Turkey of negotiating with the HTS.
All signs point to Turkey appearing as a winner as Syrians celebrate the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad and the end of the police state that started more than 50 years ago with his father, Hafiz al-Assad. But the sudden demise of the regime underscores how quickly fortunes can change in the region, and the future of Syria and Turkey's role in it are today more uncertain than ever. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Police have arrested a 26-year-old man carrying a weapon consistent with the gun used to kill the CEO of the largest health insurer. New York's police commissioner said on Monday the man was taken into custody at a McDonald's in Pennsylvania. The commissioner also said they recovered clothing and a mask, also consistent with those worn by the suspect, and a fraudulent New Jersey ID matching the one the suspect used to check into a New York City hostel. China is seizing control of critical minerals that go into the making of electric vehicles, their batteries, and a range of electronic products for civilian and military uses. Chinese companies in recent months have stepped up efforts to procure the minerals from diverse places like Myanmar, Vietnam, Morocco, and Congo. China's quest for a larger share of critical minerals is significant because it's expected to use them as retaliatory tools against the U.S. if Washington decides to dramatically increase tariffs on Chinese goods, as President-elect Donald Trump said he would. Also in China, the number of people who've successfully registered for China's 2025 National Public Service Exam reached a historic high of 3.4 million people. For many young people, securing a position as a civil servant has become a preferred choice for a stable career, particularly in light of economic uncertainties and intense pressures in the job market. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. BRICS is an organization of countries working together on trade and investment, similar to the G7 but of smaller countries. Its original members, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, are now joined by five others, and recent conversations among the member states have included creating a new shared currency to compete with the dollar. India is not supporting that idea, but is trying to promote trade in its local currency. Meanwhile, incoming U.S. President Donald Trump has made his opposition to the plan well known, threatening a tariff of 100% on products from BRICS nations if they go through with it. Anjana Pasricha has our report from New Delhi.
India is not pursuing the creation of a common BRICS currency, a potential initiative that has met with strong pushback from U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. He has threatened 100% tariffs on products from the 9-member BRICS bloc if it replaces the U.S. dollar with another currency or backs an alternative to the greenback. Analysts say mistrust and differences between major BRICS members such as India and China are a huge stumbling block in moving ahead with a shared currency. Chintamani Mahapatra is with the Kalinga Institute of Indo-Pacific Studies.
India is not supportive of this particular initiative. Any common currency is not going to help anyone. Only the dominant countries like China ultimately will dictate. So it is very difficult to develop a consensus to have a common currency.
Talk of a BRICS currency gained some momentum in 2022, after the U.S. imposed sanctions on Russia following the Ukraine war and growing tensions between the West and China. But the alliance of emerging countries is too diverse to make a shared currency viable, according to Mahapatra.
We don't have a common market. We don't have any common trade policy. We have nothing in common.
However, India and some other BRICS countries have stepped up efforts to trade in their local currencies to reduce dependence on the US dollar, said trade analyst Biswajit Dhar.
There are 17 countries that have been identified by the government of India with whom India wants to trade in either rupees or a bilateral currency.
Those countries include Russia. New Delhi, which did not join US sanctions, is paying for its massive oil imports from Moscow in rupees. Indian External Affairs Minister Subramanian Jaishankar has said that moving away from the greenback is not part of India's economic policy. That, say analysts, is because India's strategic interests are generally aligned with the US. Anjana Pasricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
Turning our attention now to the war in Europe, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky met with U.S. President-elect Donald Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron in Paris over the weekend. Following that meeting, Trump said the war needed to end, and Zelensky said that no one wanted a diplomatic solution more than he did. He also, for the first time, released casualty numbers to the public. Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
After the meeting with Donald Trump and Emmanuel Macron in Paris, Volodymyr Zelensky said that Ukraine, more than anyone else in the world, wants this war to end, and that a diplomatic end to the war will save more lives, which is what Ukraine wants. However, Zelensky mentioned that Putin does not want this war to end. Therefore, he must be forced. He can only be forced if Ukraine is strong. He said to achieve this, Ukraine needs more weapons packages and security guarantees from partners. Zelensky considers an invitation to join NATO as an important security guarantee. He noted that this was discussed in Paris and that he is going to call President Biden to discuss the possibility of an invitation to NATO before the end of his term as president. For the first time since the beginning of the full-scale war, President Zelensky spoke about Ukraine's personnel losses. He said that 43,000 Ukrainian soldiers died on the battlefield and 370,000 were wounded. Zelensky also mentioned updated data on Russian losses, saying that Moscow has lost more than 750,000 people, including 198,000 killed and more than 550,000 wounded. In diplomatic news, amid the latest developments in Syria, following the fall of Bashar Assad, Sergei Sibiha, the Ukrainian Minister of Foreign Affairs, said Kyiv is ready to re-establish diplomatic relations with Syria in the future. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And finally today, it's the day we all knew would come. Pop culture marks the end of an era as Taylor Swift's Eras Tour has officially ended Sunday in Vancouver, Canada. The nearly two-year-long concert tour was record-breaking, trend-setting, and most definitely crowd-pleasing. Craig McCullough reports.
It is finally the end of an era for Taylor Swift. The last show here in Vancouver is the finale of a 149-concert tour that spanned almost 2 years. It is estimated that it earned around $2 billion since the first concert in March 2023. Each concert lasted about 3.5 hours and featured at least 44 songs, divided into 10 parts or eras of her recording career. The tour stopped in 53 cities on 5 continents. Chris May is the general manager of BC Place Stadium, the venue that hosted the final 3 Swift concerts. He says organizing and in preparations for these concerts was similar to ceremonies for the Olympics, Paralympics, and the 2015 Women's World Cup of Soccer, which were held in the stadium. He says 70% of attendees for the final 3 concerts were from outside of the greater Vancouver area.
That means we have a huge amount of guests that have never been here before. So, you know, it's working through those realities of ensuring we have enough staffing, enough signage and wayfinding, and people to help to get people where they're going.
All told, Swift's 3 Vancouver concerts drew about 160,000 people. Jarrett Vaughan, an adjunct professor at the Souter School of Business at the University of British Columbia, says Swift's adept use of social media played a crucial role in the tour's success. He also says the COVID-19 pandemic played a part for some younger members of her audience.
I think when we look at the current audience that she has, you know, they were fairly young at that time. They didn't have the opportunity to attend concerts going through maybe middle school or elementary school. And so for them now to be able to attend something like this is pretty remarkable.
Vaughan says the legacy of the Eras Tour will not solely be Swift's use of social media, but the positivity she created for her fan base. Stephanie Burt is an English professor at Harvard College and recently taught a very popular class at the school on Swift. For her, the secret to Swift's Eras Tour and her career itself is simple. She's really good at writing songs that are aspirational and relatable.
We hear the songs and we hear both someone who's already like us and someone who we want to be more like and want to be closer to and aspire to be like. That's a rare gift to extend it that long. And the tour testifies to the persistence of her talent and to her versatility and to her ability to collaborate and organize and plan.
Vancouver's tourism office estimates the final dates of Swift's tour boosted the city's economy by $112 million. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver, British Columbia.
Craig's report brought us a nice look at the numbers and the logistics of such a concert tour, but let's hear from one of the fans.
Seeing the Eras Tour was like the funnest day ever. I went with my friends and my dad and my friend's mom, and we saw the Eras Tour in New York, and it was so cool. And as one of my surprise songs, she played one of my all-time favorite songs, and it was like so amazing, and she was so cool, and like the whole thing was so much fun. And we traded bracelets, and it was so amazing.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.